Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about my work today. So my name is Karen Alim, and I'm a PhD student in Erwin Frey's group and at the LMU Munich. And so I'm really happy that Stefan already introduced the questions how veins get into the leaf. And I'd like to sort of quantify this idea a bit. So while we are, well, especially in autumn, we are like lots of these leaves around, and we are surprised by the variety and their different shapes. However, most of the leaves display this, the same distinct ingredients, which is they have a primary vein in the center of the leaf blade, and then departing from that, secondary veins, and in between reticulating third or fourth order veins. The reason for this being is that there's one common mechanism which builds the veins in all different kinds of leaves, and that's the mechanism I'd like to talk about today. And it's known what the key player in this mechanism are. So it's on the one hand the plant hormone auxin, and on the other one the efflux carrier, the PIN protein. And actually the auxin is important, as we already heard by talks from Elliot and Eric, for lots of developmental processes in plants. For example, it's produced in the growing leaves, and it's flowing out of those leaves into the stem, down to roots, and you sort of have a constant flow of auxin through the whole plant. And actually, by having auxin produced in growing leaves, the plant signals the root how much the plant is growing on the upper side of the plant, such that the roots should also grow to stabilize the whole plant. So if we now look at this outflow of auxin in the leaves, that's precisely what's shown here. So what you do see is leaves at different stages of growth, where the size of the pictures has been rescaled. So these are supposed to be a lot larger than that tiny leaf there. Well, what you see labeled in blue is auxin via an mRNA assay. And you see that auxin sort of has these peculiar patterns, which actually form the pattern of veins of this particular plant, which is Haridopsis. So there's a strong indication that those cells where you see lots of auxin in are those are the positions where you'll find differentiated vascular cells later on. So auxin is supposed to introduce the differentiation of underlying cells. However, we can also look at a GFP labeled PIN protein, and this is a different leaf but at similar stages of growth. And you see that also the PIN proteins are just at the positions where you find lots of auxin. However, there's something peculiar about the PIN proteins, what we heard about already, which is that if you zoom into one of those structures, so here would be the stem, so the auxin is flowing out down here. So the flow, and that's particular part of auxin, would be to the right, as indicated by the arrows. You see that the PIN proteins are not uniformly distributed, but they are attached to one side of the membrane. So now it's sort of a hen and egg question. So what came first? Were they first the PIN proteins or first the auxin? And so this might sort of be resolved by experiments which had been done, that you sort of apply auxin to this developing tissue. And what you see is that from the side where you apply auxin, a new vein develops in that developing tissue. And the way I like to think about this application of auxin and inducing a polarization of the tissue is in a sense of experiments that's been done in the 60s and 70s. So what they did there was sort of they took a strand of cells, and they applied auxin to one of those cells, and they just monitored the content of auxin over time, and what they saw was a traveling wave. And I want you to think about this polarization of a tissue in the developmental stage in such an experimental setup. So where you sort of you take out and you forget about any other mechanisms, signals that might be around, and just think about how can this polarization of auxin and pin proteins take place. Well, to this end, I'd like to introduce the microscopic model looking at the auxin dynamics and the efflux carrier dynamics, and then I'd like to guide you through a theoretical analysis of exactly those equations on such a strand of cells, and define why we do see these kind of waves, and show you how one can actually compute observables, and then I'll end with an experimental idea how you could check that. So how is auxin transported? Well, this has actually been nicely explained before. So auxin, as indicated in blue in this cartoon, is a weak acid, so it lives in its protonated state in the extracellular space, and it's ionized in the intercellular. That's why it can easily come into the cell, however, it cannot penetrate the membrane from the inside to out. That's why it gets trapped inside the cell, and it needs those pin proteins, those efflux facilitators, how you might call them, carrier, whatever, to transport auxin out of the cell. And then it might enter the next cell, and hence we describe this process with a transport efficiency E. And furthermore, auxin is stored in conjugated forms in cells. So also the synthesis and the degradation of auxins may take place on a fast time scale. That's why we also take these processes into account. Hence, we can describe the amount of auxin in a cell number n, and the change of auxin in that cell number n, by a synthesis rate, a degradation rate, and a transport via flow from one cell to the other, where the flow from one cell to the other is facilitated by those pin proteins, and hence this is the net flow. So the net flow is proportional to the concentration of auxin in that cell times the number of pin proteins minus the one of the other cell. What you might see here is that I, thinking of a strand of cell that's being polarized, I distinguish only between pin proteins on the right-hand side of a cell and on the left-hand side. That's why PR and PL occur here. Then the question is, okay, so what about pin proteins? Well, pin proteins are membrane-bound molecules that cycle from endosomes to the membrane and back with a basal rate. And now the question is, so how does the tissue become polarized? I need more than just, you know, basal cycling of endosomes. And there was the idea of going back to Zachs and Mitchison, that you have an enhanced attachment, which is actually proportional to the flow, to facilitate this polarization of a cell. So what this means, so you have the change of pin proteins on one side is detachment, attachment of those pin proteins that are free in the in the cell bulk, and then this enhanced attachment, which you can easily also interpret as a decreased detachment. So what you'd have is that if you do happen to have more pin proteins on that side of the cell-cell interface, then you have a net flow of auxin to the right, and this sort supposed to feed back on the number of pin proteins that are able to attach to the membrane, so that even more pin proteins attach, and then you have a positive feedback, which leads to a high number of pin proteins on that side than on this side. If we take this model, so maybe just sum it up for a second. So we had this transport efficiency, synthesis and degradation of auxin, basal attachment, detachment of endosomes, and enhanced attachment. We know that those parameters strongly depend on environmental conditions, as For example, the synthesis of auxin is known to vary highly with light temperature and wind. To guide you through the non-linear analysis of this model I just introduced you, we will rescale the concentration and also rescale the variables that we only end up with four independent variables in the end. And so the question is, how does the tissue become polarized? And why is there a wave occurring? So the questions I ask myself, what's the underlying mechanism of a wave? And how do parameters of the model control the wave properties? And is it possible to make quantitative predictions to test that model in experiments? So how does a pulse develop if I apply auxin to a string of cells? Well, what you do have is sort of, that's what I'd like to show you on this cartoon. So this cartoon sort of resembles the black boxes of cells. The blue color coding indicates the concentration of auxin in each cell. And the orange color code indicates the number of pin proteins on that membrane. So if you think about yet undeveloped cell where no direction, no polarization is yet observable, what happens to if I auxin and the auxin has to travel onwards, that these cells have to become polarized to efficiently transport on the auxin. And what happens at the very front of a pulse is that this cell has already polarized and so is efficient in transporting lots of auxin over to the next cell. However, this cell is not yet polarized. And because the time scale of the transport efficiency is a lot faster than the one of the endosome cycling, we sort of have a bottleneck here. So it's sort of a traffic jam scenario that pulls up all the auxin, and we do see an auxin pulse traveling down. The nice thing about a one-dimensional setup is that you can go into it and redo the nonlinear dynamics and understand what kind of properties of the model contribute to what you see. And to do so, this is sort of the rescaled equations you saw before. So we look at the change of concentration of auxin per cell and the change of concentration of the pin proteins on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side. Well, as sort of, it doesn't matter if the auxin is transported to the right or to the left. That's just, you know, by symmetry, it's the same thing. So we can just assume that transport is to the right. And if transport is to the right, you see if you just sort of integrate those equations microscopically, these microscopic equations, you see that the concentration of pin proteins on the left-hand side, so opposite the direction of transport, isn't really changing at all. So you can assume that the change of these pins on the left-hand side is equal zero, which sort of simplifies the system a lot, because then you end up with a two-component system, which is still nonlinear and still coupled, but makes life easier. So if we now think of, you know, sort of the number of pin proteins tells us how polarized the cell is, and the number of auxin tells us how much auxin is in a cell, these are the two parameters we look at and how they change dynamically. Looking at these equations, what we find is actually that the change of auxin at any point in space depends on the pin proteins and the auxin, and that's particular point in space, and also on the effect of neighboring cells. However, there only gradient terms come in, and the same applies for pin proteins. So if I want to analyze this coupled dynamics just by using nonlinear mathematics, what I do is I look, first of all, so when does auxin not change with time, and when do the pin proteins not change with time? And this is just what's displayed down here. So on the x-axis, we have the pin proteins, and these are the auxin proteins, molecules. And the change of auxin is zero along that blue line, and the change of pin proteins is zero along the orange lines. What you do see see is that where those two lines intersect, we have a stable fixed point where each cell isn't, well, assuming that each cell is in the same state, this would be a state where nothing happens and the system is equilibrated. So what do these two states correspond to? Well, this is a resting state where the cell is not polarized. So looking at it in experiment, you wouldn't see that there's any pin proteins on the membrane at all, because this is a really low concentration of pin proteins. And this is a state of constant flux. So here you have a constant flow of oxygen from one cell to the other, and all cells are polarized. And now the question is, what happens to this system if I apply an auxin excitation to such a kind of cell? So what happens is the following. I apply auxin, and I'm driven past, so this is sort of, so this distinguishes the area of attraction of those stable fixed points. So if I'm on the left-hand side of this separatrix, I'd like to go relax back to that stable fixed point. If I'm on the other side, I'd like to go over there. So if I excite my systems, I might pass that separatrix and go over here, trying to relax back to that stable fixed point, but sort of the stable fixed point would be those that result when I neglect the spatial terms, but if I include the spatial terms, which is shown here, these spatial terms drive me past such that I would eventually relax back to the resting state. This is assuming a short pulse on, so short excitation. It's different if I apply a constant source. A nice mathematical point is that actually these equations only include gradients. So the usual way of thinking about, so this kind of system is described as excitable B-media, which is also used for nerve conductions and things. And there you usually use reaction diffusion terms. However, if you take the continuous limit of those microscopic equation trying to describe the auxin transport, you arrive at that equations only including gradient terms are sufficient to describe them, the dynamics. And actually, it's the gradient terms that sort of, on the one hand, enhance the excitation, and on the other hand, drive me past that stable fixed point. So in space, it looks like, in time, it looks like that. So I excite auxin and to high, very high values, and then sort of it relaxes back, and sort of I still have, because of this, all the pin proteins are still so polarized, there's even more auxin taken away from that area to that peak, so I have a bit less of auxin until it may relax again. Having this knowledge on what the dynamics are in that system, you can go ahead and try to actually compute properties of this pulse. And doing so, we were, we were successful in computing actually the amplitude of the pulse. And so that's the full analytic result, but you can sort of simplify this horrible expression to arrive at this kind of expression, which sort of shows the dependence on the kinetic parameters in a more easy way. So dependence is also shown in these graphs. So what you see in those graphs is, on the one hand, a simulation of the microscopic defining equations and the analytic solution as the solid line. And here are now changements in three of the parameters. So one parameter is the transport efficiency, and the amplitude goes up with the transport efficiency, and the amplitude decreases with basal attachment and enhanced attachment rate. So can we just sort of understand that in an easy way? Yes, we can. It's sort of, if we go back to that picture of why we do see a pulse, it's actually, so the highest amount of auxin is just in the very front cell of that pulse. So if we turn up the transport efficiency, even more auxin is transported in that cell, and so the amplitude rises. While if we could turn up the endosome cycling, this cell is faster polarized and efficient in transporting auxin, and so the amplitude goes down.
How are you turning up transport efficiency in a living?
You could change that by changing sort of the cell lengths, because then the distance is not that far it has to travel the endosomes, so that might work. And sort of these are also rescaled variables. So actually what comes in is also the amount of auxin per cell and the amount of pin protein. So I don't know, but maybe one could change the number of pin proteins by other stuff as well. Yeah. And so having these forecasts, one could think about trying to figure out working on this mechanism by doing such dose experiments where you take sort of fresh cells from, say, the leaf, which haven't yet polarized, and look at how they polarize through the application of auxin. And a crucial point would be to immerse those cells in deuterated media beforehand, because then if you only apply auxin and deuterated auxin to it, we know that we can't label auxin. So if you apply only deuterated auxin through it to it, it sort of gets, well, diluted with the existing auxin. So if you really want to measure the amount of auxin in one cell, you'd like to have all auxin being deuterated. So that would be nicer. And then you could see where your front is, as it is, could be marked by sort of GFP labeled pin proteins. And there should be a very distinguished front where you have where the cell is already polarized. One could hope to change the transport parameters and see what that changes, and try to compute the quantitative, the kinetic parameters from the prediction of the auxin amplitude. So I hope I showed you that we are able to understand why we see pulses and how they polarize a tissue, which might also be interesting for other areas, not just plant biology. And we found that's actually a bistable system that is driven to be inexcitable due to the advection terms, which drive me from one stable fixed point to the other. And we analyzed the influence of the parameters and are able to solve the dynamics by looking at the amplitude. And it would be nice if one could use this result to understand which kind of models are able to describe the polarization due to pins and auxin, and to quantify the kinetics underlying this auxin transport. Surely it would be interesting to see if one could also analyze the nonlinear mechanism due to such a flow model, how vane patterns and phototaxis arises. But this is pure future, and I'd like to thank my advisor, Evan Fry, lots of things for money, and for the nice discussions I had during this conference, and I'm enjoying the atmosphere very much. And I hope I get some questions.
So I'm sure you said it, but I missed it, I think I already. So what's the time scale for propagation of the pulses?
In those experiments that had been done, it's a micrometer per second. It's the velocity. So if you consider a cell of say 40 micrometer length or something, it would be it stays about a minute in per cell.
So which is sort of and just so I'm trying to think. So compare that with a time scale for, say, relocalizing pins.
The experiments that have been done is sort of not the yet differentiate. The experiments that have been done are done on sort of, well, maybe I'm not using the right term, on differentiated cells. So actually those cells are already polarized, so you wouldn't start from that resting state. It's sort of, this only arises if you think of the leaves where you apply auxin and you see a vein propagating in that. But there you sort of, you have, it's already polarized, but what this model actually does explain, if you start from a polarized state, what people saw is if you have a huge amount of auxin, it's not just a mere wave front that's propagating, but it's a wave front and you have a higher, I don't know, it's sort of a hill on that very wave front. Yeah, and so this hill is supposed to be in these experiments also due to an enhancement of the polarization. Well, this would at least explain it, because I get the result if I start in my simulation from a polarized state, and then you would see such a scenario happen.
And presumably, if you were to oscillate the direction of auxin, you would also see propagating variables.
If there are different scenarios, if you just put in a huge amount, you sort of have just this kind of a wave front, and everything after that wave would also stay polarized as it is polarized. And if you just apply a small source or a pulsed source, this would sort of yield successive waves.
Is there an effect of a boundary condition at the end? Suppose you have a finite terminus at the end, a sink of some kind?
I think it shouldn't interfere with those waves. So I used open and periodic boundary conditions, and
this could be, so you could make a prediction for a root as well. Or would that be different somehow?
I don't know. I'm not sure how much the cells are already polarized in the root. So if this does this make a new change to it, I'd be more happy to apply my forecast to the undifferentiated or unpolarized cells in the leaf. But surely we can think about applying it to the roots as well.
I mean, it's worth mentioning, I think, that this model's, it's probably a good first step towards the analysis of some of these feedback mechanisms we've been talking about,
yeah,
between auxin,
sure,
and pin polarity. But the data that you showed, though, from Mary Helen Goldsmith, mm-hmm, to be clear, that doesn't need, one doesn't need to invoke any kind of feedback between auxin and pin to generate that pulse.
Because you're already in the state where the pin is in its second resting state,
yeah.
So it's polarized and everything you apply to it sort of, it's...
I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, sure. So when you apply an excitation to a string of polarized cells, what just happens is sort of this auxin it's a very symmetric pulse that travels through and spreads out very fast. It's a pity that those experiments have only been done on very short strands of cells, so it would be nice to look at them at longer strands, because then you would clearly see that they die out very rapidly, while those are supposed to persist, actually.
I'm trying in my non-mathematical way to think about what each of these cells are doing. How does it know to put the pin one on the right-hand side instead of the left-hand side?
Well, that's just sort of the model input. It's basically, you're just aiming at the discussion of what kind of model. Between concentration models and flow models, so how does this feedback come about? And
either kind of model, how does it know whether it's a right hand or left hand side? The auxin is coming from the left hand side.
What's been discussed, is that the auxin has an effect on this pin site, on the endosome cycling. So one should try to figure out how can this actually affect the cycling. And I could assume that there are sort of cooperative effects.
Concentrations kind of the same on both sides, right?
The concentrations are different on the side where the concentration is larger on the side where the pins are from which the wave is coming. So if I'm at that, so maybe let's go back to this picture. So. I would have, at that cell, I would have a higher concentration of auxin in this interface than I would have on that interface. So if you presume this kind of, that you sort of measure the amount of auxin in some kind of way, or that the auxin that's transported through the membrane sort of stabilizes or destabilizes the endosome cycling, that this is pure speculation, but I could think that, for example, also the pin proteins being active sort of stabilizes their being in the cell membrane. Nobody knows. A way to think about this kind of modeling is actually that sort of this is a different mechanism than you would get from the concentration model. And I think if one would be able to do these kind of experiments, one could really try to figure out, I'm not claiming this is right, I'm just claiming that this is a way to figure out how it's really working.
Are you asking how these equations do that?
Yeah.
Okay. So these equations clearly do that.
Yeah.
Because
you have to read them.
Just to read them.
How these equations make a difference between the left and the right side?
Because sort of, oh, sorry, that's
it's just an assumption.
Yeah, that's assumption
it's
you put in.
Yeah,
it's built in. Sorry.
But you.
It's the positive net flow. Yeah.
And then it's a consequence that you will see this asymmetry of the pin develop further on because there's flux going in that direction and not the other direction.
You assume a sigmoidal, it's in this Heaviside function in there. Assume a sigmoidal. The direction of the flux matters, yeah.
Okay.
That's what you put in. Sorry, I should have emphasized that in the talk.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah, sort of, but you would, playing, sort of this is a minimal model, so you could even go ahead and say, well, I assumed all terms to be linear, except for the interaction term, and playing around and making those, for example, non-linear doesn't actually change anything on the feature of having this pulses. However, if you do play around with this interaction terms, you get other models as well. So this would result in actually Alan Newell, I don't know. So then you would have this kind of linear instability, which yield a different scenario, because then you would sort of have popping up wave. You would have sort of this would predict that you don't have a single traveling wave, but sort of a set of constant high auxin concentration and pins pointing into that direction. So if one could really facilitate those experiments, it would be a simple way to test which model works which way. And you get that from really going through that nonlinear analysis and understanding how patterns evolve from the competing or the different models.
So all the assumptions you have basically started with the 1967 experiment.
It goes back to Zach's, probably, yeah.
So that you have the traveling wave and as you have concentration on the left high, then there's a wave of auxin.
Yeah. However, those cells, as I said before, they are already in a constant flux state, so they are not in a state where they're not polarized. So it more goes back to the experiments of Zaks, where you do have where you apply, well, not Zaks as well, but experiments where you sort of have you take the leaf and you apply auxin to one side, and you see that a vein is propagating in. Yeah.
Can you just show the experimental thing that inspired your? I missed the.
No, it's sort of this is not.
The data or the.
Yeah, but this is sort of, this is a bit different scenario. So that's why it's, I'm just taking it as a stimulus to think about how to do the experiments. So I'm switching to a whole leaf to a strand of cell. So it's better to take only this with you because the setup of these cells is different. They start, they're in a different state.
But the strand of cell wouldn't work because I guess what I found interesting in this model is that the special terms make you avoid the fixed point and go back to the relaxing state behind. Mm-hmm. But for that you need to be 2D, no?
Why should I be 2D?
Why does it work? It's 1D. So then I
nearly 1D, but even 1D I have a neighbor to the right and one to the left.
Okay, so it just diffuse and they reduce the maximum and just make you avoid.
Yeah, but sort of it's because you have transport, because you're not a single cell, but you get oxygen from your neighboring cell and you hand out oxygen to the other cell. And this sort of establishes a gradient which acts on you as well.
So in fact, you could redraw it in a different parameter space where there is no more fixed point.
Sorry, I don't see, actually.